So before starting with the action principle and the first order action, so what was the main point of the lecture yesterday? What makes that quantum gravity is challenging, in your opinion? Any suggestion from what I said yesterday, or?
No experimental data?
Yeah, it's one thing. So the main point I'm going to emphasize here is also that so space-time is the gravitational field. So if you want to find the theory of quantum gravity, this means you want to quantize the field, which is the gravitational field. You want to quantize space-time. But this means that you need to quantize this field without any background structure, because this field is your space-time. Okay, so this makes quantum gravity something very different from the other quantum field theory, you know. Okay? Okay, and of course, the fact that we don't have any experimental data is also something quite challenging, because we don't have anything to compare with. Okay, so let's start now with some equation. So first I'm going to, as you should know, the action is the starting point for most quantization techniques, okay? And so I'm going to start with the 4D Einstein Hilbert action. And so you told me that you already have seen that, but I'm just going to give you the main step to derive the equation of motion. So I'm not going to do it in detail, especially because I think tomorrow you have a tutorial, and the topic of the tutorial is going to be some GR calculation, and you will do this calculation, at least one part of this calculation. The hardest part of this calculation, you will do it during the tutorial. So I'm just going to give you the steps, okay, the main idea, and then we will see why, when we go to the 3D case, everything is much more simpler, okay? And finally, I will introduce the new variables, the triads and spin connection, and show you that from the Einstein-Hilbert action, if we rewrite everything in terms of the triad and spin connection, then you get a first-order action, which is called the Palatini action. Okay, so it's going to be a bit of work to arrive here, but then we will see that the main advantage of this action is then that it's going to be much easier to quantize. Okay, so that's why we're going to, and even in terms of equation of motion, if everything is going to be much more explicit in this formulation. So we are going to spend maybe 1 hour to work on that, but then things are going to be a bit simpler, okay? Okay, so let's start with just the first part. Sorry. So just the Einstein Hilbert action. So I'm going to forget about, so I'm going to give you what is this constant, but then we're going to forget about it. So you have the determinant of your metric, you have the Ricci scalar, and here if I'm 4D, my measure is on 4D space, okay? So here kappa is given in terms of the Newton constant and the speed of light, but I'm going to forget about it. So I just put this is equal to 1. So you see that this is a functional of the metric or the inverse metric. Okay, and so to get, so this is our fundamental field here, our fundamental variable in this formulation is the metric field and or the inverse metric. We will see that it's equivalent at least at the classical level. And so then the equation of motion, you get the equation of motion by varying this action. So with respect to the metric or the inverse metric, okay? And in fact, yeah, this is equivalent because, so yeah, you can use this relation. So you know that G mu nu, sorry, I'm going to use another index here. Equal so using this relation, just that between the inverse and the metric, you get that if you look at the variation with respect of the metric, you have that. So g mu rho. So this is equal to zero. So this implies that you have this relation between g mu nu, the variation between the relation of the metric and the inverse metric. Okay, the variation with respect to the metric or the inverse metric. So you will get a minus one. So you just have to use the product rule here. So you will get g mu rho sigma j. Okay, so this means that to find the equation of motion, you can look at the variation with your action with respect to so the metric or the inverse metric, okay? So with respect to the metric, or inverse metric. And we're going to choose the inverse metric here. But you can really go from one to the other using this relation. OK, so is it clear to everyone that here I'm using the Einstein convention? So if OK, so this is my start. So I want to look at the variation of my action. And I can rewrite this as three components, OK? Where the first one, I'm going to look at the variation. So I'm going to rewrite the Ricci scalar as. And so the first variation will be the variation of the Ricci tensor okay, and it's this term that you will have to compute in the tutorial tomorrow, I think. So where you will have to show, in fact, that this term can be just written as a so see tutorial, what you want, we'll have to show is that this term can be written as total divergence, okay? So I can give you maybe just the result. So you're going to show that you get the total divergence of a vector. Okay, so this means that if we have good boundary conditions that we are going to assume here, then we don't care about this term, okay? Because it's a total divergence. And so to compute this, I think the easiest way is to use the Riemann normal coordinates, but you will, if you're not really familiar with that, I think it's also part of the tutorial, okay? So it's a good way to do some calculation. So this is the first term and is not going to enter into the equation of motion. So then the second term is quite simple because we just get that it's so R mu nu, then the variation of the inverse metric. Okay, so this one you don't have any work to do. And then for the last one, we look at the variation of the determinant of the metric here. So here, yeah, I forgot to say this is the determinant. And so I'm not going to give you all the steps, but so the idea is to rewrite, to use the general expression of the determinant of a matrix. You can rewrite it in terms of if you have an n by n matrix, you can rewrite the determinant of this matrix in terms of the component of the matrix. So the idea here is to use this general expression and then show find the variation of the determinant. But so here we have the square root of the determinant. So we get, so what here you need is to compute the variation of the square root of the determinant of your metric. And so you get that this is 1/2 of g, the variation of g, okay? And then here, so it's a step I'm not going to detail here. You just need to express g in the determinant in terms of the matrix, so in terms of the matrix element, if you want. So it's a bit longer, yeah, lengthy calculation. So I'm not going to do it here because I don't want to spend so much time on this review. And so here you get then that the variation gives you of the determinant in terms of the inverse metric. Okay, and so here the minus sign comes from the fact that I wrote my variation in terms of the inverse metric. Okay, so just using this, if you express just your determinant in terms of the metric, then you will get the variation of your determinant in terms of the metric variable, but then using this expression you can get in terms of the inverse metric, and so that's why here you have a minus sign. Okay, so here what is the last term? We just get that, so it's going to be minus 1/2 or R times g mu nu delta g. Okay, so now we can rewrite delta S, the complete variation of my action, and we get the equation of motion. So you should recognize the Einstein equation here, coming from this term and this term, okay? So let's. Okay, so from delta S, now you get that delta S can be written as so R mu nu minus 1/2 of g r mu nu, just putting together delta S2 and delta S3. Then we have the determinant here and the variation with respect of the inverse metric. Okay. And so here you recognize that this is g mu nu, the Einstein tensor, and so you get here the vacuum Einstein equation.
Excuse me?
Yeah?
Should that be g mu nu times r rather than g times r mu?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Very good. Thanks. Perfect. Okay, so the vacuum Einstein equation is just that g mu nu is equal to zero. So if you take the trace of this equation, what do you get here? We can simplify, in fact, this equation when we are in the vacuum and n is greater than 2, which is, so the dimension of the space-time is greater than 2. So what do you get if you take the trace of g mu nu? Can you see that? What is the equation, simplified equation in terms of the case of the vacuum? Yeah?
The Ricci scalar is zero.
Yeah, so you just get that the Ricci, okay, tensor is equal to zero, because if you take the trace, you find that the Ricci scalar is zero, okay? So here you get that taking the trace of the equation g mu nu equal to zero, which shows that r is equal to zero. So when n, if n is the dimension of space, then it's greater than 2 here. Okay. Okay. So this was just a quick review on starting from the Einstein-Hilbert equation. Yeah, you can recover the Einstein equation. And so you see that here I never use the dimension of space-time. Okay, so I wrote that my here a 4, but it could be a 3, and everything will be still the same, okay, still valid. So this means that if now I'm going to the second part, so to the 3D case, okay. So when the dimension of space-time, okay, because you take the trace here and you have an 1/2 here. Okay, so for the 3D case now, so everything is still valid, because so now the 3D action, well, it's still the same, okay, you still have, and you have the same equation of motion, okay, because everything I did here. So you still have g mu nu is equal to 0, and it still implies r mu nu is equal to 0. But so why the 3D gravity is much simpler here? So maybe it's not quite obvious here in this formulation. In fact, it will be much more obvious in the first order formulation, as we will see. But so the fundamental physical difference between so 3D gravity and 4D gravity originates in the fact that, in fact, the Riemannian tensor, so the curvature tensor, here can be written as a linear combination of the Ricci's tensor. Okay, so this means that in 3D, you have that the fact that r mu nu equal to 0 implies that the Riemannian tensor is also equal to 0. So this means that if in our case we are dealing with a zero cosmological constant, this means that we are dealing with a flat space-time. Okay. And so how can we see that? Okay, I'm not going to give you the expression of the curvature tensor in terms of the Ricci tensor, but we can see that just by counting degrees of freedom. Okay, so we are just going to do it and see why in 3D it works, and it won't work, of course, in 4D. Okay, so what do you know about the Riemannian tensor? You have some property of symmetry with the indices, okay? So I'm going to rewrite. So first, you know that it's anti-symmetric in the first two indices, okay? And so here we are in 3D. So how many pairs of anti-symmetric indices do you have in 3D? Yeah, very good. Okay, so here it's anti-symmetric. in the first two indices. And in 3D, this gives you that you have 3 pairs. And we see that we can replace these 3 pairs by just one index running from 1 to 3, okay? And so it's the same with the last two index, okay? The last two index are also anti-symmetric. In the last two indices. And so in 3D, this means that you can also replace that by one index running from, so here you can replace that by one index running from 1 to 3, and the same here. Okay, so now I have one index here running from 1 to 3, and another one running from 1 to 3 here. And you also have the property that it's symmetric under the exchange of the two pairs, okay? So here you have the same thing. So you have three pairs and you can exchange. So how many degrees of freedom do you have here if it's symmetric?
Six.
Yeah, very good. So here we have 6 degrees of freedom. And so let's compare that with the Ricci scalar here. So we have R mu nu. So now mu and nu can take our label from 1 to 3. Okay. So we have 3 indices which are symmetric. So again, it's the same as the same calculation as here. It's 6 degrees of freedom. Okay, and just so here for the curvature tensor, we have an additional property I haven't used. It's the fact that the totally anti-symmetrized Riemann tensor. So if you write, okay, is equal to 0, but this is automatically satisfied in 3D. Okay, so I don't need to look at this property. So you see that here, this from just this counting, so it's indirect way to see that this is going to imply this relation, this equality on the equation on the Ricci scalar is going to imply this equality on the Riemannian tensor. And this comes really from the fact that we are in 3D here. Okay? And so, yeah, once again, we will see that in the first order formulation, in fact, it will be much more obvious that the curvature tensor is equal to 0. It's going to be given as an equation of motion. So what does it mean here? So this means that in 3D, every solution of the vacuum Einstein equation with so a zero cosmological constant is flat. Okay, so this is the first result. And if you add a non-vanishing cosmological constant, then this means that you will get a constant curvature. Okay, but so here we are dealing with lambda is equal to 0. So this means that physically in 3D, so or in 2 plus 1, because we are going to deal with the canonical approach, you don't have any local degrees of freedom. Okay, so 3D gravity. The conclusion of this is that you don't have no local degrees of freedom. And so curvature is just going to be concentrated if you have at the location of matter, if you have some matter. But here we are going to deal just with vacuum, okay, Einstein equation. And so there is no gravitational waves in particular. Okay? And so this means that if your space-time is topologically trivial, okay, then you don't have any gravitational degrees of freedom at all. Okay, so really here, all the degrees of freedom you are going to get come from the topology of your space-time. So let's see. So you only have here global degrees of freedom, okay, and which depends so on the topology. Of the manifold. And this can be the topology of the manifold. A good way to characterize the topology of your manifold is with the fundamental group, okay, of the manifold. So do you know what is a fundamental group? Oh. So and this is characterized by the fundamental group. So roughly speaking, the fundamental group will count the number of topological distinct closed curves that you can have. So for example, on a plane, okay, any curve can be deformed to one another, okay, on a plane. You don't have anything. So you look at the number of curved closed curves that you have, which are topologically different, okay? And this is the fundamental group is a way of counting this curve. So for example, as I say, the plane, we are going to say that is topologically trivial, and it's the same for the two spheres. So then the first example of non-trivial topology is going to be, so do you know what is going to be the first in 2D, or 2D sphere? Yeah, what did you say?
Torus.
Yeah, the torus, very good. Or the donuts for the American. Okay, so you have a torus. And very good. So it's the first non-trivial example of non-topological trivial surface. And so why is it non-trivial here? Because you see that you can look at, so this, you have these two different curl here that cannot be, which are different, okay? And which cannot be squeezed to just a point here. And so you see that this is also flat space-time because what not all torus has flat, but most of the one we're going to consider here. Because so you can start from a flat piece of paper, okay? And the way you build the torus is if you glue together these two sides and these two sides here. So you can try it with a piece of paper. It's not well, it's not easy to do, okay? But you can try to do it, and at the end, what you get is really what we call a torus, okay? So it's still flat space-time, but it's topologically non-trivial. And so here, if we deal with gravity here, the equation of motion is are going to tell you how the lengths of these two curves are going, okay? So you are going to have 2 degrees of freedom, which are going to be this length of these two curves, and the equation of motion are going to tell you how the lengths of these two curves are going to evolve, okay? And so then, so yeah, since we are going to work in the canonical approach, we are going to assume that our space-time can be written as R times, so here it's going to be time, time a 2D surface. And so in fact, a 2D surface can be either be seen as a sphere, where we have seen that the sphere is considered as a, with a trivial topology, okay? Any curve, closed curve on a sphere is can be become just a point, okay? Can be deformed to a point. And so this means that you don't have any degrees of freedom if you're doing with a sphere. And then we have the torus, and much in 2D, so it's the last case where we can classify the topology of a surface, okay? And a more complicated surface can be obtained by just gluing. When you have many torus, you say tori, okay? So you glue together tori together, and then the G is the number of tori you get to describe your 2D surface, and it's also going to be the genus of your surface. Okay, so the number of holes of your surface. Okay, so this is just, so you can write your 2D surface as a sphere or as tori glued together. Yeah?
So in string theory, we saw that like if I have these loops and occasionally when they evolve, they split into multiple loops.
Yeah.
How do we know that like this kind of topology change is forbidden in GR and that this is a valid assumption?
Okay, so you're right that here, when we are dealing with this topology, this means that we don't have any change when, this topology is not going to change by evolution in time. But in fact, there is a theorem that most hyperbolic, globally hyperbolic surface can be decomposed like this, and it's the surface usually we're interested in, the manifold we're interested in, because of the causal structure we want, so the Cauchy surface. But you're right that this is a kind of, we made a choice here, restriction, okay? But physically, at least in GR, it says that most of the manifold you are interested in can be decomposed like this, okay? Any other questions?
This also applies for black hole solutions.
Yeah, so then, so here what we're going to deal with is either compact surface or without boundary condition. And then for black hole, usually what you add is different boundary condition, okay? And then, and you're right that even in 3D, you can, if we have a cosmological constant, you can get a black hole, but then this comes from the fact that you add some non-trivial boundary conditions, okay? Whereas here we are going to forget about.
So you're excluding black hole solutions, but even if we know cosmological constant, you're supposing that like you can slice your space time with like Cauchy at every instant.
Yeah.
and but you're considering possible black holes or not?
Yeah, so no. What I'm just saying is that to get to this equation here, G mu nu is equal to zero, at some point, you know, so it's what we are going to do in the trivial. So here, you see that you have this this term, the S1 term here, and this is equal to zero only when you have good so it's going to be a different solution. It's just what I'm saying, okay? So it's not coming from here, the decomposition of your spacetime, but it's also coming here at this point where we said that this term is equal to zero because of the boundary condition we chose. Okay?
But isn't it just because you chose not to put like the Hawkins-Gibbons term? Like, you could have put it, right?
Yeah. So so here I'm going just to focus on something already simple, because even with this simple case it's already complicated when you try to quantize. But then of course you're right that here we could add boundary condition and then add a different term here. Yeah, very good. Any other comments here? Okay, so this was just to emphasize that what is important for 3D gravity and what makes things so simple is that you don't have any local degrees of freedom, and so you only have global degrees of freedom, which come from the topology of your manifold you are going to consider. But so now we are going just to focus on the simple topology and just see what we can say already. Okay.
You said my equation of motion for the vacuum is r mu nu equal to zero, and you said it implies the space time has to be flat.
Yeah.
But if the space is either torus or sphere, like, can it be flat?
Yeah. So this is still what we call flat space time. Okay. Even a sphere. Okay, sphere is considered as what we call flat solution, okay? Okay, so so this was just to conclude on the 3D case. So now I'm going to do the change, if there is no other questions here, I'm going to do the change of variable and introduce triads, okay? Okay, so in the first action, Einstein interaction, as I told you, the basic variable are the metric variable. Okay, and so here the idea is and it's this metric which encodes, of course, the geometry of the manifold. And so now I'm going to introduce what I call triad, okay? So it's 2phi. So triad is just the name, it's because we are in 3D. In 4D it would be called tetrad, or you also have this, you can also say it's n by, coming from German. And where n here will be the dimension, okay? But so here we are in 3D and I'm going to talk about triad. So what are triad? The idea is that at each point now of the manifold, I'm going to introduce an orthonormal frame. Okay, and this orthonormal frame is going to be described by my triad. So at each point, of the manifold, so you get a field here, so it's in 3D, so I'm going to get the field of three vectors, okay? So I get I, where here I go from 1 to 3, okay? So the fact that they're orthonormal, here orthogonality imply that G mu nu E mu I mu J. Okay, so this is just let's write like this. Where here now it's what I call the co-triad here. And so this is delta ij. So here, just to emphasize, it's because we are dealing with an Euclidean signature. And so what do we get if it, I was dealing with a Lorentzian signature? What would be here the result? Yeah, very good. Okay, so it will be just the Minkowski metric if Minkowski okay, so here already I can emphasize, so this is going to be the metric for what we call the internal indices. So, okay, the ij are going to be what we call internal indices. And so, in fact, you're going to use this metric if you want to raise or lower some internal indices. But you see that since it's the Euclidean signature, in fact, we are not going to really care if it's low index or high index, okay? So it's just... But this is because we are dealing with Euclidean signature. Okay, so I'm going sometimes to write something with an index like this or like this, and it's going to be equivalent here in this case. Okay, so I'm not going to take so much care about the internal indices. But yeah, you still have to be careful. It's really because we are dealing with the Euclidean case. Okay, so it's going to simplify. So yeah, so we have here the triad, okay, and here is going to be what we call the co-triad. And so now, if I'm contracting this equation, okay, so I'm going to contract this equation with some. So first, let's define the triad. Okay, so the co-triad. So the co-triad here is just defined from, so this equation, when you contract with this equation with I mu, so it's given by G mu nu. Now I'm contracting this equation, A mu G. Okay, and so this defines the co-triad, and now I can contract again this equation with another co-triad. So E mu k here, let's say, and what you get, so from this equation contracted with another triad, you get that G mu nu can be written as in terms of co-triad. So maybe I should rewrite this equation somewhere else because it's a very important equation. So I'm going to go here. And so what we get here is that the metric is the pullback of the Minkowski metric, or here the flat metric, to the tangent space. Okay? And so this is what the equation here told us. It also told us that so G mu nu can be expressed in terms of the co-triad. So you see that we started with the fundamental variable, with the metric, and now we are going to rewrite everything in terms of this, here the co-triad and triad, okay? And so let's check the number of degree of freedom here. So here we are in dimension 3, and so it's symmetric, okay? So again, you told us that here we have 6 degrees of freedom, okay? And here, so it's 3, but also times 3. So we have 9. OK, so what do you think? So we introduced here, this means that we introduced some irrelevant information. OK, so what does it mean? That means that we will have an additional symmetry. And so can you see which transformation I can do on my triad, which is not going to modify the metric? Yeah, very good. So we have you have a small frame at each point, but you can rotate this frame. And then it's not going to affect your metric. OK, so this means that we have an additional here gauge symmetry, which is a SO3 symmetry because it's a rotational symmetry. But we are going to usually say that into SU2 symmetry, OK? Because in fact, well, I'm going to explain this in a second. So here we have an additional symmetry, which is a SO3 gauge symmetry. And indeed, you can rotate your small orthogonal frame, and you're not going to modify it. So this comes from that you can modify u the x can be written as rig and this can be done at any point of your spacetime. And this is not going to change the metric. OK, because so if you apply this transformation here, then what do you get? So you get that you get R. I mu, let's say. So I apply this transformation to my two fields, LG, AG, mu. And using the fact, so these are rotation metrics, OK? So this means that you have that, it's an orthogonal matrix. So the transpose of R with R is equal to identity. OK, and so you can simplify this, and you get exactly, again, G mu nu. OK, so here I said that we have a SO3 gauge symmetry. Then most of the time I'm going to talk about a SU2 gauge symmetry. OK, but it's because so. Yeah, in fact, what we are going to deal with is one form, which are going to be Lie algebra valued, OK? And you know that the Lie algebra of SU2 and SO3 are the same thing, OK? So I can talk about SU2 and SO3. And usually, we prefer to talk about SU2 because then we can make the link off with the SU2 lattice gauge theory, which is well developed, OK? So that's why most of the time, we are going to hear that in loop quantum gravity, you have a SU2 gauge group symmetry. Yeah.
Use SO3 or SO2?
No, so here, really, it's not going to make any, so you don't have any fundamental difference because we are really going to deal only with Lie algebra valued object. OK, so at the level of the Lie algebra, it's really equivalent. OK. OK, so OK, so this is our new variable. But we see that we will have an additional symmetry. So this means that when we are going to rewrite this action, Einstein-Hilbert action, so here I do not really emphasize on it, but here the symmetry was the diffeomorphism, OK, gauge symmetry. And so now in this action, we will have, again, of course, the diffeo symmetry, but an additional gauge symmetry, which is going to be so the rotation. And so at this point, so we can write the metric in terms of the of this new variable, but you know also that what we want is to be able to do some parallel transport. Okay, so we need, we're going to need a covariant derivative, which is going to be consistent with this new framework. Because so now we have object with so internal indices and with space-time indices. So I know that at this point, at this stage, it seems that everything is more complicated than what we had before, but no worry, at some point it's going to be interesting to have introduced this variable. So here I'm going to use this Latin letter to describe the internal indices, so I, j, k, etc., and the Greek letter mu nu for the space time. And so here the transformation rule for these indices are going to be with respect to an internal rotation, as we have seen. Okay. So internal rotation. And so of course you still have the mu nu space-time indices where you are dealing with tensor object. Okay, so here we have space-time tensor. And so you know that in GR you introduce the covariant derivative with respect to the space-time indices in order to have it was needed for parallel transport. But also, if you were starting with a vector, then you apply the covariant derivative. You wanted that this new object was a tensor. Okay? So here now we have these additional indices, the internal indices, but we would like to have something similar, meaning that we want to parallel transport object with internal indices. And then we want that once we apply the covariant derivative, our objects still transform well under the internal transformation. Okay? So this means that we still have the covariant derivative here. So with respect to the space-time indices, which was defined in terms of the Levi-Civita connection here. So this is just the standard covariant derivative, which was needed, so as I said, to parallel transport, and in order to get, when you apply that to a tensor, then you still get a tensor. Okay? But so now be careful because we have this internal. So this is the standard one. We have internal indices now. And so we are going to introduce a new connection, okay, because we want to define a covariant derivative with respect to these internal indices. So this covariant internal indices. And so for this, I'm going to introduce this what we call the spin connection, which is also going to depend on space-time and I'm going to denote this new covariant derivative with d mu, okay? And so d mu on a vector with respect to the internal indices is going to be defined as just the partial derivative plus, so I have to check the sign. Okay, it's okay. Okay, so this is your definition, but so this is a simple object, okay? It's just like a vector for the internal indices. But what is going to be the covariant derivative for an object which has an internal index and a space-time index? Okay, so let's see what this means. So in fact, you are just going to combine both covariant derivatives. So now, if we, for example, we want to take the covariant derivative of such an object, where here you have an internal index and here a space-time index, then you just get that this is going to be given by, and then for the space-time index, you use the Levi-Civita connection, as usual. Plus, so the same thing here, g mu k v k. Sorry.
The quantity is like some scalar time period dimension.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can see that like this. Okay. So indeed, we will see that the triad can transform an object, a space-time object, to an object with internal indices. Okay. So yeah, when we go from this formalism to this formalism, we are going to deal with only space-time index indices with object with space-time indices, and then you go to the internal index using this with the triad.
Okay. So, for example, phi j is a scalar for.
Yeah. So here, phi j is considered as a scalar with respect to the.
Okay.
So this means that here, if you want, if you use the standard here, is equal to.
Okay. What would be the, if I want to expand, for example, the object that you just wrote, like v nu j?
Yeah.
How do I expand that in a basis?
Okay, so here you have.
Just like down dx nu.
So here, if this is comes just from a space time index, this means that here you are dealing with this, but I'm going to explain that in a moment. You are dealing with this. Let me see. So here, yeah. So you want only one index here. So I guess you get. Sorry. How do you get this one? And then I guess you get. No. And you come from this one. Good question. From this particular object.
Would you just like expand for like v nu j times dx nu tensor?
If you want to write.
Like ej, tensor ej. With EJ being a vector.
Okay, if you want. Okay, if you want to decompose that, and
yeah,
also on the space-time basis,
yeah,
it will be something. The only thing I'm confused here is because the E are also has a space-time index.
No, but like E I mu dx mu, right?
Yeah.
That
okay.
Would be,
yeah. Yeah. Right. Thanks. Okay, so so this was the covariant derivative just with respect to the Levi-Civita connection, and now, so the idea is that we want to write everything in terms only on the triad and the spin connection. Okay, so in particular, this means that we can express this Levi-Civita connection in terms of the triad, and so where does this come from? And also, so what you want, okay, so you, is it clear to you that indeed you can use the co-triad here to go from, it's going to transform space-time indices into internal indices. And so this means that you are going to contract your space-time index with this cotriad to get an object with internal index. And so now, if you want to take the covariant derivative of this new object, it's going to be the covariant derivative for with respect to this internal index. But you would like to be able to do this before or after the contraction. So this means that we want to add a condition, so the compatibility condition here on this covariant derivative. Let me explain compatibility condition, which is just going to be that this covariant derivative is going to annihilate the cotriad. And because this means that now you can change space-time indices into internal indices inside before taking the covariant derivative or after, okay? So this means that everything is consistent, okay? So you can work as you prefer. You can work with only space-time indices and then at some point say, oh, I want to introduce my internal indices. So, or you can take already the work already with internal indices. And it's going to be consistent with your derivative this way, okay? So this makes sure that the derivative commute with the contraction, in fact, okay? To make sure that the derivative with the contraction. And so from this condition, we are going to get a relation between the Levi-Civita connection and the new spin connection. Okay, because so if you write explicitly what this means, okay, so this means in terms of derivatives that you get mu k, j, and e k, rho. Okay, is equal to 0. And so in particular, now if you contract this equation with again with the triad, so mu k, here, you get an expression for the spin connection is equal to minus g mu. Okay, so we're here, you see that I already simplify my expression, okay? Just using the, sorry, you cannot see it anymore, but just the usual. So here it's the usual, the standard covariant derivative, just written in terms of the Levi-Civita connection. Okay?
I'm not sure why the condition should be closed. Of course, it could be nice. Is it our freedom to choose the combination, or is physics let us enforce the condition?
Yeah, your question. So you will see that with this condition, then because the idea here is that you really want to rewrite so your Einstein-Hilbert equation with all these degrees of freedom and the covariant derivative you know in terms of this new variable. But so yeah, you need this condition because you are going to deal with you are going to transform all your objects which were only space-time objects into into object with internal indices now. And you want to have the freedom, yeah, so I don't know if it's really a physical question, but you want to be able to do this before doing any calculation or after, okay? So you really need to have this condition to make that it's commute, otherwise this means that you cannot really go from one aspect to other aspect to the other formulation, okay? Because here you are going to compute, for example, the equation of motion, or you are going to look at geodesics and stuff. And if you want to translate everything in this formalism, you need to have this new covariant derivative, and in particular, you need to be able to do that once you wrote your new object. Okay, but I'm going to come. Yeah.
Isn't this equivalent to asking the metric to be like to be the connection to the metric?
Yeah. So no, not yet. But we will see that indeed. If now, so here I just express this spin connection in terms of the Levi-Civita connection. So now let's say, okay, I want to consider my fundamental variables are the triad and the spin connection. So I forget about everything else I know from the Einstein-Hilbert formalism, okay, the usual metric formalism. And so now, indeed, you can re-express. Here you can say, okay, in this derivative, in this covariant derivative, I have a connection. So what are the conditions now on this new spin connection? That has this connection is the Levi-Civita connection. And we will see that indeed, if you want that your covariant derivative, so your Levi-Civita connection is metric compatible and is torsion free, okay, this implies that this is antisymmetric and is also torsion free, okay? So, but I'm not sure I have time now, but so it's what we're going to see tomorrow. So now we're going to consider that our basic variable are the triad and the spin connection. And starting with this variable, we see that indeed, if here we really want to have the Levi-Civita connection, this is going to impose some condition on the spin connection. In particular, that this spin connection has to be antisymmetric and also torsion-free. And yeah, I think I need to stop here because Raymond is already there. And you need your break. So. So thanks for your attention, and yeah, if you have any other questions, you can of course come, and we can talk, and see you tomorrow.